Turns out vitriolic sphere is just lemon juice.
It's a molar joke, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I got you. I got you.
Live from the Mundangerous Unseen University in New York City, I'm your host, Shane.
And I'm your host, Ishan.
And welcome to episode 365 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're continuing our homebrew series and talking about creating spells. But first, the party figures it out in the Gates of Morning campaign. And later, Bulma can build anything in the Character Creation Forge.
Ishan.
Yes, Shane.
Did you finish Rebel Moon Part 2,
oh, The Scare Giver? Hell no. Absolutely not. I forgot it existed since the last time that we spoke, and now you've reminded me, and now I'm angry, so this is going to be an angry episode.
Okay. Well, did you at least finish Fallout?
I did finish Fallout. Yes, I prioritized finishing Fallout.
Pretty good, right?
Yeah, yeah. I liked it a lot. I'm not going to go back and play the video games because, like, nobody got time for that. But yeah, no, it's great. And I'm looking forward to season 2.
Yeah, which, I mean, seems like it's already greenlit. So at least there's going to be a season 2. It's not going to get Amazoned.
Right. I think what I saw was, what is the takeaway? Now that media literacy is dead, we need to, you know, fully explain this. It is, be careful what you wish for. You want to be a cowboy? Guess what? You get to be a cowboy. You want to leave the vault? Guess what? You get to. You want to become a knight of the Brotherhood of Steel? Well, yes. Yes, you do. But here's a giant ghoulish monkey paw.
That's kind of the theme of the game, to be honest.
Yeah.
It's all monkey's paws all the way down.
All the way, yep. Mm-hmm. Monkey's paws, brought to you by Vault-Tec.
All right, shall we get into the Gates of Morning campaign?
So the Gates of Morning campaign is our 5th edition D&D game set in Eberron, a sequel of sorts to the original Morning Glory campaign. And deep in the Demon Wastes, the party is trying to stop the quarry from finding the Gatekeeper's seals and unleashing the chaos of Zoriat onto the Material Plane. Gersi the Mindseed grows impatient and takes the fight to the party. She disappears, then rematerializes on the island of rock in the lava pool, close to where the party has gathered. The force of her mind blasts them all at once, sending Zan, Bramble, and Lenore reeling, unable to move.
In desperation, Vesicott wills the Mindseed's limbs to freeze in place, throwing the last of his magical reserves to heightening the effect and making it more difficult to resist. For good measure, he bends her luck for ill, and the hex finally sticks. For a brief moment, Gersi is unable to move, and Switch pounces. Two quick stabs deal critical wounds, and with a gasp of psionic power, another of Valkyrie's vessels crumples to the ground, dead.
Without a leader on the Material Plane, the quarry descend into chaos, fighting the fiends incoherently. Now that the interloper is gone, the pit fiend turns its attention to the party once more. Warden scoops up the unresponsive companions and deposits them near Switch, whose aura soon revives them.
The pit fiend takes to the air, intent on carpet bombing them with fireballs. But Bramble steps forwards with a taunt. You know, I think I've figured out this game. We're not supposed to fight you at all. I think we're supposed to tell you to f*** off. And with no one to stop him, he calmly walks over and picks up the orb that controls the pit fiend. What happens if I tell you to go back to Kyber?
The fiend smiles, a toothsome grimace.
You'd free a devil of my power? I doubt the gatekeepers would approve.
Honestly, we've bigger things to deal with. Go to hell. With a crack, the pit fiend and the bearded devils vanish back to the infernal wastes, leaving only quarry corpses behind. The roar of crumbling stone continues, and the flow of lava changes as a new section of the cavern is revealed, one that holds a ruddy tower covered in interlaced geometric lines.
Near the base, a stone carving of a dragon seems out of place. And when the party approaches the gate, the statue hums. A moment later, a human woman with hair the color of rubies steps out of a vortex of flame. She seems utterly unconcerned at being so outnumbered.
After a glance at the gate, she says, "This artifact is under the protection of the chamber. You'd better have a damn good reason for bothering me. It's been a bad century."
And we'll find out what happens next, next time. So this time we are continuing our series on homebrewing stuff for your campaign. And we're talking about spells. So very specifically, this series is about homebrewing things for your home game. It is not necessarily about like grand game design, but I think the advice is still pretty applicable if, I don't know, you happen to be making your own game or you work at a at a game company. But in general, it's just about tailoring the things that you make to your table or even a particular campaign. So I guess to kick it off, what is it that we mean by spells? Spells are any kind of finite supernatural application. For our purposes today, that's an umbrella term for anything that is spell-like, right? Including force powers from Star Wars, channeling, key-powered abilities, right? Like even like superpowers, comic book superpowers that have to be activated could work with what we're talking about today.
Right. These are the abilities that break the laws of physics and therefore break the simulationism of the game.
Specifically, we're talking about a thing that you need to decide to use, right? And that usually means that it has limited uses, right? Like Superman being invulnerable doesn't, you can't turn it on or off, right? If the angrier Hulk gets, the stronger Hulk gets, that's not a spell or a spell-like effect because it's just always there. And it's also like, it's not concrete enough, right? It's determined by the story. It's determined by plot, right? If Hulk needs to get madder, Hulk gets madder and therefore gets stronger.
And in those cases, we don't necessarily need to homebrew it because the narrative will take care of those truths.
Right. If what you want can just be handled purely via narrative, then you don't need to homebrew anything. Don't worry about it. Move on to something else. You could, however, model something like Spider-Man's web slingers, right? And the different forms that it could take. For example, helping him to travel or capturing bad guys in sticky webs or things like that, right? Like an ability that you activate and it has limited uses and mechanical effects. A spell has mostly predictable effects and costs, or at least it's predictable to the player and the GM, maybe not necessarily the PC in-game. The trick with homebrewing is determining what is a reasonable outcome for a given spell and what's a reasonable cost to the character for using it.
So let's talk about the appeal of homebrewing spells. You've got hundreds of them in the books. Why would you bother to do this?
It's because you can customize the magic to the party, right? Like we talked about magic items before. In the same way, it is extremely unlikely that you need to create enough spells for every possible type of spellcaster, every class, every, you know, force tradition, right? A game designer probably needs to or eventually needs to make enough splat books to do that. You do not need to because you do not have every type of spellcaster at your table. So we're not talking about designing an entirely like new coherent magic system. For you, focus on spells that will actually be used by players in your game. So this means talking to your players. Sometimes, unfortunately. What kind of magic do they like? What do they want a spellcaster to be able to do? What do they want their Jedi to be able to do?
Yeah, and what is their goal for magic? Like, is it something that they want to be able to use now to solve a problem or fill a gap? Or is it something that, you know, has value or use in the future of the campaign, right? It's like something they want to be building towards.
Right. Mechanically speaking, what's their build? And what is it that's lacking? Why do they need something outside of what's available in a book? And your answers will run the gamut, but those answers will determine three things about the spells that you're going to make. The purpose, the scope, and the parameters. The purpose is, what does this new spell do, right? Both, why does it exist in the game world? Like, why did someone, assumedly, create it in the world, in the setting? And then why does it exist mechanically at your table? The scope would be, how large of an effect does it cause? Again, both mechanically and narratively. And then the parameters are just very specifically, what are the mechanical definitions that come along with the spell?
Okay, so then how do we go about building a spell?
I think there are two ways two general ways that you would do it. One is, does your game have an existing magic system, or does it not have an existing magic system? If it doesn't have an existing magic system, then I don't know, save yourself a lot of trouble and don't mechanically build a magic system. Just handle all your magic narratively.
Right. That's beyond our scope.
Yeah. If it does, then you really need to get mechanical. You want to take a look at the parameters, not necessarily of the spell right away. You want to spend some time, even before you homebrew a spell, is looking at the entire magic system. What are the levers that you have to work with when creating a spell in whatever system you're using? What are the parameters of other spells, of existing spells? What changes between them? What makes them different from one another? And how do you change them? And how does that affect how they're used, who uses them, how strong they are, how good they are?
So this is things like, is it an area effect? And if so, is there a shape advantage or disadvantage to that area? What kind of things can it target? Is it, you know, any creature? Is it only allies? Is it only enemies? Is it, you know, only certain types of living creatures? Is it only certain types of objects?
Right. And very clearly, it should become obvious what is better, what should cost more, right? When you're building the spell, right? A bigger area of effect is almost always better, although not always necessarily, right?
I mean, unless there's side
effects. Not, right, it's not a friendly fire, exactly. More targets is almost always better, especially if you can choose those targets.
Right.
Action cost. There is, in every game system, a cost in terms of turn expenditure that is required in order to use a spell, whether that is you can do one spell every time it's your turn, or depending on the number of kinds of actions you have, different spells will cost different numbers of actions, a swift action, a bonus action, one versus two versus three action spells in Pathfinder. You know, probably in like a more narrative system like Blades in the Dark, you can cast one spell per action roll. You probably can't cast a whole bunch of spells or spell effects per action roll.
Mm-hmm.
And then other costs, not just the mechanical, like how long does this, how many seconds does this take me in game, but other costs like material components. Is it obvious that I'm doing this? Do people get angry that I'm doing it? Do I need to be standing on the ground? You know, do I need to be flying in the air? Does this only work underwater? You know, all of the does little fiddly bits about spells.
Does it cost me a year of my life?
Right. or does it cost them a year of their life, in which case, I don't care. Like the fighter was going to last 50 years anyway.
Right.
speed. How quickly can you do this? This is like, is it a 10-minute ritual? Is it an 8-hour ritual? Do I need 5 people in a circle chanting for 6 days? Maybe you do. Maybe that's a great way to limit the power of, you know, your world-ending ritual. It probably should take a while.
Persistence. What's the duration of the spell and how long do its effects last, either for better or worse, right? So if you're stunning a creature into silence, how long before they can move? How long before they can speak? If you're dealing damage, is it damage all at once or is it, you know, damage inflicted over time?
Yeah, if you turn them into a newt, how long are they a newt? How long before they get better?
Right.
And then look at the effects. What happens to the target or, you know, whoever's in the area of effect, whether that is damage, harm, if there's some sort of status effect, like this is when you're looking at your keywords, your conditions, the penalties that your game allows you to inflict on other characters. And then can it affect the environment? How would it affect the environment? And is that part only narrative or are there concrete mechanical effects on the environment?
Yeah, this is your fireball sets flammable objects alight. It's like, well, hang on. all flammable objects? I am technically flammable.
Right. Yeah. How flammable does it need to be? Is this instantaneous heat? I don't know if you ever tried to set wood on fire, but it actually does take a while.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So flash paper and my hair. Great.
Right. Right. Material components, your eyebrows.
You also want to look at the utility of the spell, right? So if there is something that can be done with the spell kind of outside of its core use, right? This is your wall of stone can be used to, you know, create a ramp, right? Or your wall of force can be used to, you know, create a prison, right? A magneto prison, if you will. Any of those kind of like melding stone or transmute mud to rock or rock to mud. I can't remember which, right? They create effects that they aren't intended for direct conflict resolution, but they create new capabilities and add utility that the party otherwise couldn't get.
Yeah. How, I mean, things like unseen servant, right? Like there is a cost to taking that spell. It mostly exists for world building, honestly, right? Like unseen servant, it's rare that you're like, I'm an adventurer and today I will pray unseen servant if you're not like having a dinner party later. But depending on how it's written, there certainly can be combat applications. Maybe you want there to be combat applications, you know, like I have an invisible force that I can control. Yeah, that could come in handy.
it's just an invisible blocker.
Right. I do remember the Morning Glory 1 party using teleport, not offensively, but certainly in combat to say, we got what we came for, we're leaving. We're no longer engaging with this battle.
Right.
I don't care how many hit points it has. In fact, effectively, this is power word kill.
Banishment was that all the time.
Right. And then narrative. I mean, D&D is the big, like, is the elephant in the room in general, right? And traditionally, D&D allows larger narrative effects for spells, especially as add-ons, only when you go higher in level, right? So, like, there are mechanical options for Wish. There are also definitely narrative consequences for Wish.
Right.
But also, like, if you cast an 8th level spell, like Earthquake has very clear mechanical consequences, as does Tsunami, but they also have extremely powerful narrative consequences that are just not touched on.
Namely, there is an earthquake.
Right. You destroyed a city.
What could that mean for the surrounding area?
There was a tsunami. But there's no ocean here. Well, there was no ocean here.
That's fine. A wizard did it. Don't even worry about it.
Right. I mean, you know, I do get advantage on intimidate checks from now on, right? Like anyone right. who saw that, I should. And you can have spells that are just entirely narrative. And I think depending on your system, that is fine and even potentially worth it for some players to be like, yes, I will pay whatever the opportunity cost is to be able to cast, you know,
legend lore.
Yeah. Well, yeah, sure. I guess, or, you know, a terrifying spell that, you know, wows an audience and they will remember it and tell the tale to their grandchildren forever. You know, like, is that better than true resurrection? Maybe. Just depends what you care about.
Right.
Okay, and then the next thing to look at is the intended power level of the spell you're trying to create.
Unlike a lot of other things, I think you are working within the confines of an existing magic system, so the power level is probably very clearly delineated. It is either, you know, a whatever fifth rank spell, right, which has a sort of relatively narrow purview of what it should be capable of doing compared to every other fifth rank spell in your book, right? Or it's a standard action light side force power, you know? And again, you have a bevy of them. You can see like what is and is not included in the effects that those things do. That gives you a very obvious starting point and something to measure it up against.
And I think when you have, when you don't have that clear delineation, you need to look for something the party can already do or something that already exists that is comparable in power level that you're looking for, right? If nothing is giving you the number, then you've got to go find the equivalent that you're working from.
Yeah, I think a trap that often maybe that homebrewers fall into, but also I think definitely game designers fall into, is too much verisimilitude with their magic, right? They think, okay, in the story, what should the spellcaster be able to do? And they create a spell that lets them do that without necessarily looking to the other characters in the party, whether or not they have magical talent, and saying, what is this character capable of doing? What is the general power level? What is the effect of that they can have on their environment or the story or the enemy? And making it comparable, right? Like, this is how we end up with quadratic wizards. We say, oh, well, it's magic. They should be able to do anything, while limiting martial characters. But like, good game design, good design for your table means looking at the given power level at a, like, in a snapshot of time, right? Which almost always means everyone is the same level or has the same amount of XP or the same number of advances or whatever. And a character who can access this spell at a particular level should not be able to do a great deal more than an entirely different character who was also at that same, like a level of power and ability and advancement.
Sure. But I mean, not like spell level isn't an inherent quality of spells, right? Like, there's also like, if you've got a build for point buy, right? Like, you have the same problem, right? So you're always like, you have to find whatever the baseline is that you're going to build a power off of, right?
Right. Like, you look at mutants and masterminds, right? And you can pick any power that you want at any time because you're just buying it with XP or points or whatever, right? But there's a point cost associated with a particular kind of power. So look at the other associated point costs, right? And obviously, if like all energy beams cost 5 points per level, then don't make yours cost 4 points, or don't make yours cost 6. Now, at this point, you might be thinking, I don't really know where to peg this. We'll talk about like utility powers more in depth in a little bit. But I think one good way to sort of like peg this about like what is it that I want the spell to be able to do, or, you know, when talking with a player, what do you want it to be able to do, is to sort of interrogate like why the spell exists. And you can start with the lore. That's fine, right? It doesn't necessarily mean verisimilitude in terms of real world physics, but you can say, all right, why does this spell exist? Who made this spell, right? Is this an Autoluke spell? Is this your character's spell that you are creating and no one's ever done it before? And how has it been used in the past? Is this going to be something that like people are going to be shocked by when they see it? Or is it something that is going to be everyday magic in a lot of places? And that gives you some like pretty clear guideposts, not necessarily on like how to do it, how to like write your spell mechanically, but how to like properly do the gut check about whether you're going down the right path when you are making a spell.
We mentioned comparing to existing spells, right? And sort of gauging power level. I do think you need to make a decision whether you want your spell to be like in line with those, weaker than those, or, and most dangerously, exclusively better than their kind of equivalents in their slot, right? Unless you are literally just trying to replace a spell with a better version that is better for your game, you probably want to keep homebrew spells, you know, roughly in line slash kind of orthogonal, you know, better in the circumstance of your campaign, but not necessarily more powerful in general.
Yeah, I think it's sort of weird for me to say this, but I think you can look at Magic the Gathering as like having done this well at times. I don't usually say Magic did anything well, but there was, at least for a long time, a design philosophy that no individual card should ever be exclusively better than any other individual card. This is one of the reasons that they removed dual lands, right? Like you could tap for one kind of mana or a different other kind of mana, which was just better than basic lands, which you could only tap for one kind of mana, right?
But, yeah, and all the Mox cards too.
Yeah, right. But I think that has softened since to basically be like, some cards can be strictly better than others because they are more rare. It is harder to find them. And, you know, when you're playing a competitive, like, you know, game based around rules and very little RP, that's one thing. But when you're at a table, I think I would agree that, like, if you are going to have something that is just strictly better, right? Like, hey, I took a look at the fireball spell. My spell does 1d6 more damage. Like, is that a lot more damage? No, probably not. But it is just strictly solely better, and there's absolutely no reason not to take that spell over fireball, right? I think it is okay if that spell exists, or a spell that is even much more powerful. As it's okay if it exists. There just needs to be a cost, and that cost is probably, it's really hard to find, and there was a quest. And you did a quest, your whole party did a quest, or whatever, and you're like, you got the amazing thing. That's what a magic sword is, right? Like, you went out and got the master sword because you put all the pieces together, and you reforged it, and blah, 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 and now you have a really kick-ass sword, and it's stronger than every other sword out there. That's allowed. Right. You can do that with spells. It's okay, but just make sure that they earned it.
Yeah, while you were out studying the blade, I was being a nerd studying my spell book, and I finally created the perfect spell.
Yeah, it's called Melt Blade.
Yeah. It's called Immunity.
To what? No, that's it.
No, it's just blanket. Just... blanket immunity.
Right. So now you have so many levers. That you have identified by, you know, sort of digging through the bits and bobs of the magic system that you're trying to work within. Now you can actually sort of get to the work of trying to write, essentially, a new spell. So like I kind of alluded to, the easiest way to make a new spell is to just change one or more of the elements, right? One or more of the levers we've just talked about to something equivalent. So you have Fireball. You change fire damage to psychic damage, and now you have synaptic static. And actually, you change other things too, because synaptic static, which does, you know, psychic damage in a sphere, probably doesn't set things on fire.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, like, the main thing about synaptic static is that instead of setting flammable things on fire, it sets things with minds on fire.
Right. It gives them penalties. Great.
Yeah. You've also got like cure wounds. Well, if you don't want to take a full action and touch somebody while to heal them, you can look at healing word, right? Which is the bonus action, ranged version of cure wounds. So it's more flexible in how you can use it and when you can use it, but it does half as much healing.
And I think this is sort of like the two main reasons that you're going to have people approaching you for a new spell or that you're going to want to create a new spell. It's when you look at the matrix of your spells, which I would highly suggest that you do, right? If you can sort of imagine a chart that lists all of the possible parameters, right? This is like a, you know, a 9-axis chart or whatever, but that lists all the possible permutations of spells that you could have with area of effect, action cost, number of targets, damage type, blah, 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 all of that, right? You would see that there's no way that any one game system fills, like ticks every single one of those boxes, right? Some of those are filled, some of those are not. And it's very reasonable for a player or for you as a GM to be like, okay, but I want this with two of these things changed and it doesn't exist. And it probably doesn't exist for lore reasons more than anything else. You can just change that and it's fine. And or the other reason you might do it is the cure wounds healing word thing, where for many years people were like, I never use cure wounds. Why is that? Well, it's because it takes too long in combat. I waste my turn. Well, great. Now healing word exists. And healing word was created by adjusting just a couple of those parameters so that it was actually more useful and coming at a cost, but actually that cost is worth it, right? It is a cost. Right. It is a measurable, meaningful cost, but it is still worth it.
Well, then you've got your sort of like your flip side of that is, in my party, I have only one healer. They have to spend so many of their prepared spells on different versions of healing. For my game, I'm going to make a homebrew version of Cure Wounds that just allows you to healing word as well.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. So instead, I can use either version of it in one spell slot. Right. And it's like, oh, that is strictly better than Cure Wounds or Healing Word, obviously, since it's just both combined. But also, I'm the only healer, or I only have one healer in my game. I just made their life more convenient for doing the party friendly thing anyway. And there's no one there who's getting outshined by this.
Right. And lore wise, it doesn't really matter how you explain this. It can either be the spell Cure Wounds always had a healing word capability, and that's just how everyone knows it. Right. And so Cure Wounds and Healing Word don't exist in their as written format. They're only the new one exists. And, you know,
right.
In game, it's always been like that. Or, you know what? It could just be that NPCs have the book version and PCs get the homebrew version. That's also fine.
Right. Or it's, you know, Agnes's healing word.
Right. Right.
Only Agnes has this.
And that's also fine.
Her word
if you
is
want,
better.
If you want, like, hey, there's one healer in this party and it's Agnes, right? It's actually, right. Maybe I would actually probably prefer that over only PCs get this too. Like, only Agnes gets this. You get to shine. Why? Well,
right.
One, you're being the healer and you're, it's for all of us. We all benefit, right? But also, like, now we've actually tied it to something interesting, and we can build off that. So when you're looking at that, for lack of a better term, matrix, right? If there is a hole in it and you want to create a spell that slots in there, just consider, is there a reason that that spell doesn't exist? Like, is it just happenstance and, like, you can't print every possible version in the book? Or is there a reason?
Yes.
That, you know, an area effect permanent stun doesn't exist?
Also, yes. Both things can be true, Ishan.
Right.
It's almost certainly word count. But if not word count, then bad idea count. There's very few ideas that can't be worked into a game under the right circumstances. It's just a matter of whether or not those circumstances are broadly applicable enough that they're gonna be worth pursuing, right? Like, there's no reason you can't have a 1 mile radius area effect stun. In D&D, that's a 15th level spell that would take days to cast. So how are we going to do that? Right?
Well, in third edition, I could probably do it at fourth level.
Well, okay, sure. Yes, fine.
To the optimization
room. Or third edition is a bad example.
Yeah.
What was that spell that enabled everything terrible? The 1 mile radius.
Oh, locate city.
Yeah, locate city.
Right.
Well, locate city, like, bomb. I'm sure you could turn that into a stun.
I'm sure you could. Yeah, absolutely. And persistent divine metamagic.
Anyway. Ugh, ugh, ugh.
Well, so this is something that comes up a lot for me in Star Wars games, right? Where for lore reasons, there are so many force powers that have the light side descriptor or the dark side descriptor. Why? Because that's the way that it was in a book or a movie. And so, like, you know, this set of mechanics that is essentially a spell now is either evil or good, which blocks it off completely from a bunch of different characters. I've built Star Wars characters in different systems where I've been like, hey, GM, I just want to be able to use Force Lightning, but not be a bad person. I don't need it to be, you know, hate coruscating from my fingertips. Can it just be lightning? Because it looks cool. Can it just be that and not evil? And, you know, some GMs have been like, sure, I don't care. You know, if you want to use it to, like, jumpstart your speeder, that's also fine. And others be like, no, absolutely not. And then I have to be like, okay, I'm going to go learn a Force secret so that I'm not evil. I don't gain a dark side point every time I cast Force Lightning. That is design space that is open. Although in Star Wars, usually you make a light side version of a dark side power or a dark side version of a light side power, right? Like, oh, here's the crappy version of dark side healing. Because dark siders have no staying power.
I don't have a dog in this fight. my observation with Star Wars is always, oh, you're not allowed to do that until somebody definitely is allowed to do that. So I don't care.
I mean, it happened with D&D, like in previous editions where things would get like the evil descriptor or like the necromancy tag, and a necromancy spell would like always be evil or whatever, you know?
Right.
Until suddenly, like one edition, they were like, oh yeah, no, healing is necromancy as well. I mean, now it's not, but right. I think for a while it was. Like,
yeah, it was destigmatized the necromancy.
Right. Oh, no, we're conjuring new hit points. That's what we're doing.
Right. I'm shouting your arm back on. Don't even worry about it.
But think about, you know, what combinations of parameters are underrepresented in your game. And if that is the complaint that your player has, or that's the complaint that you have with the system, great. That's a good place to start. Like, basically, pretty much, if any D&D player came to me and was like, can I have a poison version of this spell? I'd be like, yes. Yes, you can. Also, you probably need to make it stronger.
Yeah. Oh, can I have a spell that's just like half the monster manual has resistance to and doesn't straight up work on like 8 different creature types? Go for it.
Yep, I believe in you. Uh-huh. We're going to make this work.
But to be fair, there is an issue there, right? Which is like, oh, well, in aggregate, poison is weaker. Should I buff it? Or in my game, I control what's available, mm-hmm. right? So if the party has a poison specialist and I am not giving them a chance to shine with their poison specialty, like, that's on me, right? Like, as the GM. So do I need to give them a buff to poison? No. I need to have already designed the game around the party that I have, right? I'm not obligated to choose randomly from the monster manual in order to get a proper distribution of resistance types.
Right.
This there's no like platonic ideal of the resistance distribution of a D&D game.
I mean, this is a good point, right? Like, do you need to homebrew a dozen different poison spells, or could you just homebrew one feat that says you overcome poison resistance and give it to them? Or could you just be like, oh, you're a special poison person with a crazy poison bloodline and it just works, you know? Because like, look, snakes can bite spiders and spiders can bite snakes, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Hashtag not all poisons. Right. We all drink the polonium tea eventually.
But think about, like, does this exist simply because the game was designed with verisimilitude as the primary objective? And if so, you can throw that out the window if it is useful for you and your party and your player.
Right.
I don't mean to harp on 5th edition, but like, there's like no acid spells. Acid's not particularly weak. They just didn't make acid versions of spells. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it might be weak. It could just be high concentration.
Yeah, that's true. Turns out vitriolic sphere is just lemon juice.
It's a molar joke, yeah.
Yeah, I got you.
Hey.
Let's talk about utility spells for a bit. You know, harking back to what we just said, especially with utility spells, do you need to homebrew a spell? Because obviously a utility spell, one that simply makes the plot go forward, right? We go from plot point to plot point plus one, can just be narrative. Or if you really want to like put the agency in the player's hands, it can be mechanical. That is also fine. It could be some combination of both.
Right.
But like, I think probably one of the most common ones here is just travel, right? Like getting from one place to another place. And there are a lot of different ways that can sort of hash out. In fact, being able to travel farther is actually probably less useful than being able to travel shorter distances, right? Like it's a question of plot, for me to be like, okay, how do we get to the other side of the world? It is a combat question of, can I teleport to the other side of this door?
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's like, and it is a weird thing where, like, you know, teleport circle is very carefully circumscribed of how you can use it, how you create it, all of those things, all in order to just make what is an annoyance no longer an annoyance, right? But because it's written generically and for publication, it has to have a bunch of parameters around it so it's not weaponized. But in a single group, right, you know, the, like, Mordor's accelerated travel, Mordor's express lane, right? Like, you can just do that. Your wizard can just have a spell that allows, like, you know, for the length of this campaign, we can easily teleport between these two locations, no problem, don't even worry about it, right? And it's like, hey, I just took care of our fast travel problem, and now we're not burning a seventh level spell every time we try to go between two major cities, right, where our campaign is happening.
Right. I mean, Baldur's Gate 3, it's two clicks, and it breaks nothing.
Right, exactly.
And it would be unplayable without it.
Right. But I mean, you know, teleportation circle still has value, right? In the world building sense, teleport obviously still has value, given that you don't have to have, you know, been between two fixed locations before. Like, you're not breaking anything that exists. All you're doing is, like, removing the problem that is distracting from the goal of your campaign, which is not the road between, like, Am and Baldur's Gate, right? The game is Neverwinter and Baldur's Gate.
Yeah, and this reminds me of, like, when you're setting power level, like, the reason that teleport is a seventh level spell is because it opens up the world. It's because it's hard to GM. It is not necessarily right. Because it is so game-breaking. It is potentially story-breaking. That's why it's gated off at seventh level.
Right.
If at your table, you know that the players are going to stay on task because they are, both as players and as characters, focused on accomplishing the mission and finishing the campaign, and you don't need to worry about them, you know, teleporting off and gallivanting, then, like, a spell like teleport could be lower level, you know? Doesn't matter. So think about, the verisimilitude reason that a spell has a particular cost or the parameters are set such as they are. But for utility spells, like, look at the mundane problems that the party encounters. Look at the things that they complain about. Look at the things that take more time at the table than you want them to take. Obviously, you can handle them above table, but you can also just toss in little Easter eggs or, you know, hand them a book of utility spells that can be cast as rituals or, you know, like, cantrips can go in any game, right? Like, for most narrative magic systems. I mean, I hesitate to say that Harry Potter is a coherent magic system, right? But, like, they seem to be able to use magic whenever they want, as much as they want, until, I guess, they fall asleep, you know?
Right. Like, there is no reason, if your party doesn't have somebody who can pick locks, there's no reason that you can't have a middle ground ritual whereby, you know, a wizard can be the lock picker using their intelligence and their, you know, their casting DC or casting bonus, right? Like, the reason, like, that's there for roll protection. Knock is an automatic spell, so if you just don't want to roll, great, you can use knock. But, like, if you just need to pick a lock, like, the wizard can do it with magic. That's okay. Like, you can give them, you know, those types of things too, and then it's just added to the spell book and it's a thing you're capable of doing, or it's just an arcana check or whatever, right? Like, you can allow these things as long as you're not stepping on other people's toes and minimizing their contribution and their, and, you know, eroding their niche.
Right. So you look at these mundane issues, right? Like the locked doors, vision, right? Seeing in the dark. Use utility spells to make everyone's life easier. No one wants to track concealment. No one wants to track dim light versus bright light versus infrared or ultra vision. Nobody wants to do that.
Unless you have a gloom stalker.
Right. Well, in that case, I'm taking darkness and screw all of you.
Right.
Carrying capacity. Repairing mundane objects, you know? I think you go one of two ways. Either, no, don't waste magical ability on this. Don't make somebody like memorize a spell in order to like handle these things. Unless you have somebody who really enjoys doing that. Like if someone really wants to be the Batman wizard and they're like, hold on, I got a thing for that. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. I mean, and that's where like understanding your players is important, right? Like sometimes nobody in the party cares and you can do that. Other times, like, you know, you're playing a support character and you want the win, right? Like it's fun for that type of player to like be able to solve that problem for the group. So give them a way to do that. And now everybody gets a win, you know, four players for not having to deal with this ever again. And one player for providing that solution.
So now that you know what you want your spell to do, take a look again at the parameters around resource expenditure, right? Like what does it cost to use this? First off, how often can it be used? And this is like in a traditional Vancian system, this is how many times per day can you cast the spell, which is also tied to what level it is. Sure, whatever. Yep. For force powers, there's every Star Wars game has some mechanic telling you how often you can use a force power. And the main thing that you as a player need to do is be able to cast the force power that you want to use, like your main attack force power, as often as possible. And then what does it cost? Like, what does the spell cost to learn? Or I guess to find, to learn, to keep it on you, either in a spell book or in your head, to use it in the moment that you actually do use it. And then what does it cost you if you lose it? What is the opportunity cost for using it? Obviously, learning one spell means you're not learning another in most systems, right? You have a finite number. Even wizard spell books have a finite number of pages and cost money, yeah, right?
I would like a spell to remove that, please.
Yes.
Just get another spell book.
Or because
they only had one grimoire?
Yes, just the one, the arcane grimoire. Cost you gold, right? And then this is something we haven't talked about yet, but maybe ends up being like the most useful bit of information is, does the spell require build support? Does it require your character to be capable of something mechanically or narratively in order for it to be useful? And if so, then like you're basically just making things for one person and you don't really need to worry about the balance nearly as much because they're the only one who can do it. So you're not destroying your world or your world building. And you can just see how strong it is on this person. And if it's too strong, then you have a conversation about the table and be like, I want to dial this back, but I'm going to do it in game, you know?
Yeah. I was going to say that's where you can get into some of the unintended consequences of you've created a spell and now the players are changing their build to support the spell. and now it's, uh-oh, what have I done, right? And that's kind of the genesis of the horror story of how do I carve this back or like claw this power back from the players now that they're like fully invested in it, right? So you do want to be aware of like what's out there in the system that they could then use to synergize perhaps unintended consequences.
Look, anybody is allowed to learn this spell. It's not a problem. I don't know if I mentioned, though, it's a warlock-only spell. So, yes, there will be costs. They will not be mechanical.
Yeah.
You're going to make some new friends.
Right. All right, so what are some alternatives to actually creating a mechanical spell in your system?
I mean, it's a lot easier in certain other systems, but, like, just make it purely narrative, right? And, like, you know, something like Blades in the Dark is already kind of halfway there. With like, I'm trying to accomplish a goal. It really doesn't matter if I'm doing it with a spell or not, right? Like, if I'm rolling whatever skulk to like secretly relocate myself, the game system doesn't care if my character teleports or sneaks. You know, like the action rule is exactly the same.
You could also just use, you know, plot magic, which I think you introduced with the, was it Resanguinate? Was that the spell that you created for Morning Glory 2?
Exsanguinate, which can then be reversed into resanguinated. Yeah.
Oh, sanguinate. Okay. Yeah.
Right. Which, but, like,
right. So,
look, is it powerful? What does this do? Oh, it empties in one action, empties all the blood from a body. Yes, that's way too powerful. Oh, it has to be dead. Oh, well, then it's not powerful in any way.
Exactly.
Perfect. Okay.
It's still objectively powerful suction, but not so powerful mechanically.
Right. Oh, it's reversible? Yeah. So you can put all the blood back in a corpse? Uh-huh. In one round? Yeah. I guess actually sometimes that is useful. Yeah. If you're also trying to follow up with a revivify, yes. And I think if you're having trouble wrapping your head around this, I mean, let's just spend just a little bit of time talking about the styles of, like, spells that you're potentially trying to create. Again, like, J.K. Rowling sucks, but Harry Potter in general, like, enough of us know about it that it's a good touchstone, and it's a really good example of a poorly designed or maybe not designed at all magic system. And that's really evident when you try to, like, move it into something a mechanical representation of that magic system, which is, like, what is the scope of the spells that they have? Like, how strong is a Jelly Legs Jinx? And why would you ever do that versus, like, an Avada Kedavra?
I love about the Harry Potter magic system is that sometimes talented children don't know how to do Wingardium Leviosa correctly, and yet everyone in the world has never missed an Avada Kedavra in their lives, a spell that no one is allowed to know and no one is allowed to practice, and yet no one has ever made a mistake when casting it. Weird.
No one has mispronounced it. It's because Avada Kedavra is powered the same way as the Hulk. You just need to be angry enough.
Right. But it's like every other spell has, like, oh, you've got to learn all these little, like, techniques and, like, correct, you know, movement of your wand, and it has to be channeled correctly and blah, 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 blah. And it's like, except for the one spell that we banned, it's like it was too powerful. The only way to prevent it from being OP is to say you can't use it, because otherwise people would be running around willy-nilly.
And that's the thing, right?
Ridiculous. It's like, magic system.
Okay, usually when you're homebrewing, usually what you're trying to do is take something in your head and translate it to the table, right? Which usually means translating it to paper first and then playing it out at the table. And when I imagine, like, Harry Potter fights, it's like, it's so difficult to do in a way that makes sense narratively at a table, because it doesn't make sense when you think about it on the page of the book. Because, like, if an Avada Kedavra hits a stone statue, it destroys the stone statue. Okay. But that also means it didn't go through the stone statue. So, like, why is every wizard not carrying a shield? Like, tower shields, baby. Like, come on. Oh, we have shield spells. No, you don't. Canonically, those don't work on the green ray. And also, apparently, they last, like, I don't know, a tenth of a second, because you got to keep casting it over and over again. And you can't just project a bubble. Fine, whatever. Anyway.
Okay, Shannon, you should complain about Harry Potter.
Right. Right. So anyway, I don't know. Don't emulate Harry Potter in a game. That's probably the easiest way to do it. Or go strictly narrative, right? Versus something like Lord of the Rings, which is very much plot magic. Like, people are, like, using magic, but they don't know they're using it. Like, everything Enough does is magic. Versus nothing Enough does is magic, right? Like, walking is magic to an elf, because, like, you don't fall through the snow. Why? I don't know. Gravity doesn't affect you. Looking at things is elf magic, because horizons don't matter. Fine, whatever. But again, plot magic. Does Gandalf cast spell? Doesn't matter. That's not an action that he takes. Gandalf accomplished his task.
Okay, wait. Now do Star Wars.
And I think the Star Wars novels are actually, like, a pretty decent example of, like, someone looking at a piece of media and saying, all right, I need to basically create fan fiction of this. I need to recreate this in a way that makes narrative sense to someone who has studied the original, you know? And if I make the Jedi run too fast, jump too high, choke too quickly, then people will get angry. And I think a lot of the times when you are homebrewing a spell, especially if it's based on like something else and you're trying to translate it, you're doing the same thing as like, you know, an expanded universe Star Wars writer where you're like, all right, how far is too far? What can I get away with? How right. many times did Vader do this? Did he sleep between doing that?
Right.
Does he need to sleep? Is the suit helping him or hurting him? And then I guess ramping this to like the max would be like D&D novels are basically like, you know, take your game and like just do a recap of it.
Yeah, exactly.
In conclusion, change little bits of one spell, make a different spell, see if you like it. If you need to change it more, do it more, right? Hey, make an upgraded version of this by making it cost more and do more.
Yeah, and as always, when you're introducing homebrew, right, have a dialogue with your players, right? And make sure that players understand, like, nothing is set in stone until, like, we know and we're comfortable that it works. And if it becomes a problem, we can always walk it back.
Yeah, that spell was too powerful and destroyed the universe, so the Beyonders remaking it. Yeah.
Yeah.
The universe without that spell.
The spell unlearned itself.
Yep. Astronaut paradox.
Do you hear that, Ishan?
Nope, because it never existed.
Well, that can only mean one thing. We're going to the Character Creation Forge for the first time. But before we do that, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at TotalPartyThrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.TotalPartyThrill.com.
We're also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
And join the conversation on Discord. There's a link in the show notes.
All right. It is anime here in the Creation Forge, Character Creation Forge, which means that the whole month it's anime characters. And as a tribute to Akira Toriyama, the creator of Dragon Ball Z, who passed away earlier this year, it's all Dragon Ball characters.
I heard about that.
Yeah, look at you with your anime knowledge.
Well, yeah. It bled into the mainstream a little bit. But anyway, yeah. Okay. All right. So who are we doing?
We're doing Bulma.
Is it a Goku?
Well, remember one time we did do Goku years ago. Was it really, a
Vegeta?
It was really more like a tire kicking, you know, because look, Dragon Ball characters are capable of casually destroying planets, which is just not really a thing that you can do in D&D. So it's really more like, do you capture the flavor or the feel of this particular Dragon Ball character? Good. Now, Bulma, we might actually really be able to get there because Bulma is a regular human. If by regular human, you mean probably the smartest person in existence capable of casually creating a time machine.
Okay, but he is not a Dragon Ball.
Bulma is not a Dragon Ball, no.
Okay. Hey, I learned something today.
Bulma is a smart lady. And she's one of the one of the very original characters in that she shows up in the original Dragon Ball, meets a child Goku, because she is hunting the Dragon Balls. She's got a radar that she created that can track down Dragon Balls, tells you where the, like, what direction the nearest one is. And her father created Capsule Corporation, which is this miniaturization technology kind of along the lines of Ant-Man, I guess, where, like, you can fit pretty much anything into and a little, like, pill-sized capsule, and, like, you throw it on the ground and it goes poof, and then turns into the full-size version of it. So she'll have, like, vehicles in her pocket or, you know, sometimes a house or pretty much any equipment that you want. She's also capable of making, like, ray guns or, like, she can build anything. Anything. She also made, she recreated Vegeta's Saiyan power armor, which is capable of taking, like, oh, I don't know, like solar systems worth amounts of damage because they, you know, Saiyans are punching each other.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I have more questions power scale than answers, is ridiculous. But... okay. All right. So what I'm hearing is she is a she and also is a nerd.
Yes. Uh-huh. Makes okay. stuff.
Well, I learned two things today.
There you go. Makes anything.
Great.
Which, of course, means the build is at Artificer. Alchemist Artificer 14, Conjuration Wizard 2. The important things here that you're really getting are, why is Conjuration Wizard here? You know why. It's because you can make any non-magical piece of equipment anytime that you want. Is she creating it out of thin air? No, she's pulling it out of a capsule. So pretty much at any time you reach into your pocket and yes, you have that thing, it is in a capsule, you make it. All right, human. I think the feat that we'll take at first level is Strixhaven Initiate. This is one obviously from the Strixhaven book. We haven't talked about it before. It's kind of like Magic Initiate in that you can choose a couple of different cantrips from a specific magic using class. The important thing here is you can choose intelligence, wisdom, or charisma as your casting stat, which means that this feat gives us an intelligence-based vicious mockery, which is okay. great because obviously she's intelligence-based and notoriously sharp-tongued, married to Vegeta, a Saiyan who obviously can destroy entire galaxies, and yet
that works.
He's not immune to psychic damage, friends. I also like Eldritch Initiate. That gives you one Warlock invocation. Take the one that gives you Detect Magic at will, and there's your Dragon Ball radar. If you want to go longer distance, that's fine. Locate Object exists as a spell that you can take if you go to like Wizard 3. But honestly, if it's on the other side of the world, just handle that via plot.
Mm-hmm.
Three levels of Artificer. The important thing here, you know, yes, you'll be able to fix anything. You'll get Infuse Item at level 2. You can make all different kinds of items that you can then hand out to other people in the party. Bulma is not a combatant. She doesn't fight. Yes, she can build a ray gun. You can have a firearm if you want. That's fine. That's not your main thing. Your main thing is giving stuff to other people so that they can fight. But Artificer 3 gives you alchemical potions. You get a random one the first time, and then after that, you can choose an effect that you want by spending a spell slot, which is basically what Bulma does, which is rifling through her storage that she has with her through a bag and being like, oh, is this useful? Is this useful? No? Okay, well, how about this? Is this useful? Yes, that probably is very useful. Eventually, you find something that's useful. So if the first potion isn't helpful, that's fine. You can immediately make one that is. And then, like I said, probably go to Wizard, maybe go all the way to 3. 2 is important to get the Conjuration feature. 3 gives you second level spells and Locate Object. And there's Bulma.
All right. Well, I have once again learned something about anime that I will have forgotten by the next episode.
I think this one's going to stick with you. That's what I think.
Well, only one way to find out. But before we do, let's take a moment and thank our Patreon supporters.
Your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all of our awards at patreon.com/TotalPartyThrill. And now supporters at any level can listen to the shows ad-free.
So what do we have planned for next week's episode?
We are returning to the 5th edition class tier list, and we're talking about the Monk.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building Master Roshi.
Well, that's it for episode 365 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.